federal tax developments for the week of July the 20th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we'll be looking at this the week after our April 15th that came 3 months later of July 15th this year, looking at what we have now that we're in a much shorter extension season, right? The regular tax season ended, the extension season now starts, and of course, our first extended returns are due in 2 months. So we're looking at that. Remember, the next big due date coming up is September. So we got a little bit of run here, maybe about a month we can breathe, and then we have to worry about all of our pass-throughs that have to be done by the time we get to September 15th. So we'll be looking at all those neat things to handle. But this week, we're going to take a look at a few developments. Some of them impact, some of them are still related to various relief provisions related to COVID-19. But for the most part, except for the initial one, we're going to talk about things that are not directly, at least, COVID-19 related. Now, one general topic may unfortunately become COVID-19 related, but the cases and questions did not arise out of a COVID-19 situation. So let's start with our first thing that does relate to relief we received under the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, and actually also came through the CARES Act. And this is an IRS news release this week, which is IR 2020-158, issued on July the 15th, the due date. And this relates to some information the IRS is providing to us about letters that are being issued from the IRS related to taxpayers who have sent in Form 7200 Advance Payment of Employer Credits Due to COVID-19. Now, as you may know, the IRS is getting back in the office. Notices are going out again. And what the IRS is going to explain here are some of the notices that, specifically two letters, that are being issued related to issues that arrive when people file these Form 7200s. And, you know, the catch is if you file one, there are two things the IRS wanted to point out about why you might get a letter. First thing is, there is a letter 6312, which is basically what you would expect that the IRS has. For instance, what if you send in a Form 7200 and there's clearly a math error on it, right? You know, the things don't add down, they don't subtract properly, it simply doesn't work. Or you send one in and based on the information on the form, you clearly don't qualify for a payment. Well, 6312 will either tell you about how they changed your payment, so that, you know, you're going to get a different amount than you would ask for, or it's going to tell you about the fact that your claim is being denied. So that information will come out in the new letter 6312. They also, though, bring up another letter, and this one makes sense because obviously you're offering free money. One of the key aspects in taxes, when we offer free money, you know, basically, you know, you file this thing, we send you a check, it's fully refundable. There's a nature for people to potentially come in and try to defraud the system. It's amazing how that works. Well, because of that, the IRS has a letter 6313. And generally, if I'm going to try to steal money from the refund numbers here on the Form 7200 for advance payments of the credits, what I'd probably do is try to get information about a business's EIN, which relatively simple to do, right? We give that out to everybody. We give a 1099, W-2, et cetera, to. So there's a bunch of people that have that information or people who we need to, let's say, file a W-9 with. So, you know, we've given this out to a bunch. It's not that tough to find out the EIN for a business if you start looking at all. But the catch is I don't want to ask for $20,000 and have it go to the company because that won't help me. Again, I want to steal. So I'm going to probably want to change the address so that payment comes back to me personally. And then I can deal with setting up a fraudulent bank account, getting the money, and walking away with it. Well, the IRS figured that's what people might try. So they have a special form letter. It's going to come out and say, we need you to confirm your address. And generally, they make it clear that they, you know, if you don't respond to that, you're not getting paid, right? And they're not going to process the form or change the last known address until you provide that verification of new address information to the IRS. So this is kind of the issue to address the potential fraud that would arise from people trying to steal money from a program, giving away free money, which is pretty much a given that that's going to happen to some extent. So not surprising that we have that. Just be aware of it, though. If your client has, and I assume for some businesses it may very well be true, that, you know, the address down at the office, since we've been shut down, maybe we're operating totally virtually. Potentially, there's nobody there, so we might want the letters now instead to come to a different address, you know, like to the officer's home. Well, yeah, that might slow up the processing here. Just be aware of that. They're going to probably want some confirmation. Next up, we're going to talk about a couple of cases here, and this is a topic which is these two cases have nothing directly to do with COVID-19. But there's been a lot of speculation that due to issues with the economy, due to problems we're hitting, due to potential problems we're going to hit, you know, based on how COVID-19 does not appear to be going away quickly, you know, it's still around. And as you may be aware, I'm here in Phoenix, so we can tell you, yeah, it's still around, been aware of it going on. So if that's negatively impacting business, which it is, basically because you're going to find that a lot of people are not willing to go out. They're not willing to spend money right now because they're afraid of the economy. They're not spending money because they just aren't going places. They don't feel comfortable going places. So we have a lot of that going on, especially older individuals are less likely to go out in the current environment. So we have a lot of negative things. Now, if you're a restaurant or something similar that operates on relatively low margins and really depends on having your volumes up in order to make all your fixed costs, having people not coming in is a big problem. And that big problem may lead to some individuals' businesses shutting down, some debts not being paid, and conceivably those people, again, their business is shut down, their income's gone away, you could see things like homes being taken and that sort of background. You know, that sort of issue. And depending upon what happens to the real estate market, if this continues for quite a while, I mean, I know right now the market doesn't look too bad in many places, but the catch is, you know, eventually if the economy were to fall apart bad enough, real estate will follow eventually. And if that happens, you could get people who have things taken from them and the house, let's say, will be worth less than the debts outstanding on it. So we may be getting back into this whole cancellation of debt. There'll also be credit lines that aren't paid. There'll be other weird issues. Now, as we all know, generally, if you borrow money, you don't trigger income recognition. So bottom line, when I go to the bank, let's say I go to the bank and get a credit line, borrow, you know, and take $10,000 out of the credit line, that's not income because there's no accession to wealth is a term the courts like to use. And that means is I'm no better off because although I've got 10,000 cash in my hand and it's real cash, I can see it. I also just picked up an offsetting $10,000 liability. So my net worth did not change by 1 cent. I have no accession to wealth. And therefore, it's not considered taxable. However, if later on it turns out that the bank gives up and decides I'm not going to pay the debt and I'm going to be able to, they give up, the debt is discharged, you know, the debt is simply canceled by the lender. The lender gives up collection or for whatever reason doesn't go after collection. That's considered income at that point. Under Section 61A11 in the code, you're going to find very specifically that cancellation of debt is considered income. Your clients want to know, how can that be income? I've lost everything. It's like, because the law says it is. The real reason is because it is now an accession to wealth. Your net worth, or at least your negative net worth, you know, kind of went up some, right? Became more positive. You know, you were underwater by $200,000. The $10,000 credit line debt gets canceled. You're underwater by $190,000. So your net worth got better, or at least less worse, I guess is the way we could phrase it. And so there's the accession to wealth. It's taxable. Now, we get into a quirky problem, too, when this comes up. And this, if you remember from the real estate crisis, we went through this in real estate courses I taught years ago for Nichols Patrick. We had some nice long discussions about the concept of the problem is if a debt's non-recourse, that's where the bank loans you money and says, we are only going, you know, if in fact you cannot pay, we can take the building, but we will not pursue you for collection. Now, normally the bank doesn't say that, but in some states, you're going to find out that we have things called anti-deficiency statutes that effectively say for certain loans, And most normally it'll be residential real estate where the person lives in the house, that some or all of the debts of that nature will, at least in some conditions, be that sort of non-recourse. The lender, they can take the house, but they cannot pursue collection, right? So that's it. If that happens, if a debt's non-recourse, if they take the property and extinguish the debt, you have sold the property for the balance of the note. Okay, that's basically how this works. So we have a sale for the balance of the note. Well, that's how it works. That's what we deal with. That's a little different. So now it becomes key on a note. Do we have recourse or non-recourse? Why I'm mentioning that is because one of our cases today is going to be the key issue. Now, if you have actual cancellation of debt, Section 108 provides relief from having to pick up that income, right, from the debt cancellation income in certain situations. So in certain situations, you won't have to pick up that income, right? You'll be able to defer it. Now, normally there's some trade-off. You reduce basis, you reduce carryovers of some sort, but in some way, shape, or form, we end up with the cancellation of debt not being in the current year's income. We might lose NOLs. We may lose basis in some assets. We may have various things happen, but normally we're just not going to be considered to be cancellation of debt. It's not going to be an issue. Let's say not going to be income in that situation. So with that, let's consider two tax court cases this week because they both deal with issues of at least cancellation of debt with a residence of some sort. The first case we're going to deal with here is the case of Duffy versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2020-108, issued on July 13th of 2020. Now, this deals with a couple of weird things. This case is actually going to talk about a short sale. Now, you remember from the real estate crisis, right, what a short sale is. I have a house, right? My residence is worth now $800,000. My mortgage is $1 million because the market has collapsed. So I may have paid $1.2 million for this house. It's only worth $800,000. Now basically I can't afford to pay for the loan anymore, or I get transferred, who knows why, but I need to sell the house. Turns out that, well, I can't sell the house because I can't pay off the mortgage. And buyers are a little picky about these things. They don't like buying real estate with liens attached to them that have not yet been extinguished. And so I have to figure out a way to get the debt extinguished. Well, the bank knows that the property is not really worth as much as it was before as well. So what the bank agrees to do in those cases is they agree to take, let's say, whatever the net cash available after all the expenses of sales are paid, they will take that and treat that as full satisfaction of the debt. What that means is when we go to the sale at the closing, the bank will release the lien. And that will allow the sale to go through. Why would banks do that? Banks do that because their alternative is going to be to just take the property. And realistically, the property is going to sell for only the $800,000. But they're going to have to do all the work now of listing it, trying to get it sold, etc. I'm probably far more motivated, shall we say, to try to do that sale and get it done and to get the highest price because I've been really didn't want to have to go the short sale routine. So most likely they're going to get the most money if they go through with the short sale rather than take the property and then hope somehow they'll do better. So they tend to agree to that. Now we have this little issue. Now the other issue we want to deal with is the case of those anti-deficiency statutes. As I mentioned, some states treat these anti-deficiency statutes. What they say is we're going to go ahead and, you know, we think it's not a good thing from a public standpoint, let's say public policy standpoint, to have people who are thrown out of their homes then be pursued for $200,000 or $300,000 of additional debt out there. So we're just going to say that by statute, you know, if you borrow money, you know, you decide to lend somebody money to buy a house, that you can secure the house, but we're not going to let you pursue the person for additional funds on the shortfall, right? In that standpoint, you can take the house, nothing else. Now, that's an absolute anti-deficiency statute, and we only have a few of those that are absolute, and they only apply to certain special cases. My home state here of Arizona probably has the broadest general purpose anti-deficiency statute. But in a lot of states, the issue becomes this. In these states, and most states do not have this statute. Let's make that clear up front. Most states do not have an anti-deficiency statute. So you're just going to find in most states, this would not be directly impacted. But especially Western states, it was part of the populist movement back in the early part of the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. So those states are part of the populist movement of a lot of times tend to have this. We saw some of these come up in the 30s. So California, Arizona has it. We have variants of them in Oregon, Washington. You know, a whole bunch of states have variants of anti-deficiency statute. But in many cases, those statutes say, you know, what they really say is, well, we're going to let you pursue a deficiency if you want to go through the formal judicial foreclosure. However, we're going to give you the option of going through the shorter, you know, using the trust deed foreclosure process. So you can foreclose on a deed of trust, which is simpler, quicker. It skips the whole judicial aspect of it. But if you go that route, then you cannot pursue a deficiency. So if you want to pursue a deficiency, you need to go through a formal legal foreclosure process in the courts in front of a judge. If you're willing to skip that, then we'll let you do it quicker and easier, but you give up the right to pursue additional collection. That is one of those choice of action issues. Now, the question is, if we have a mortgage, I have a mortgage, the lender could pursue me for a shortfall if they want to go to court, or they can go the, you know, trustee sale route, and they can't pursue me for the additional funds. And we know that in these states generally, 99.99% of all foreclosure actions go the deed of trust route. The question becomes, is that a recourse or a non-recourse debt? Generally, the loan itself will never say it's non-recourse, so they'll preserve all their rights. So if they use that same loan language for a loan in, let's say, New York, they'll have the right to collect the deficiency. I'm never going to say we're not going to take it there. So the IRS position historically, going back to a 1999 private letter ruling, has been essentially that if there's a choice of action, then realistically, it's a recourse loan. And there is a forgiveness of debt when the lender decides to go down the route that bars collecting the deficiency. And that becomes a cancellation event. So in their view, if we have that $1 million loan, $800,000 due, the lender decides to pursue the administrative foreclosure, right, through a trustee sale, in a state that says, well, you do that, you give up the right to collect the rest, but you could have gone to court and gotten it. Well, the IRS position is, well, that was a forgiveness of debt for $200,000, subject to tax under Code Section 61A11, potentially subject to exclusion under 108. But if it's not considered that, it's considered to be a non-recourse debt, then I would sell the property for $1 million. Now, that's fine. You know, in theory, if it's my house, I paid $1.2 million for it. That's just going to reduce the non-deductible loss, and who cares? But let's change the facts there a little bit. Let's say that non-recourse loan was instead a home equity loan. And actually, I only paid $100,000 for the house to begin with. But now I've got this $1 million loan, and they come back and they collect taking on it. Well, now I've got a sale of it, $1 million, a $200,000 gain on sale. And the problem I've got is 108 won't help me because there's no cancellation of debt. 108 will not help you unless you have cancellation. So there are definitely circumstances where having that treated as a non-recourse debt could hurt the taxpayer. But again, the IRS position had been, and this has been their litigating position and was in the case in question. And the other catch is we have this problem of how does a short sale work? A short sale is not a foreclosure. Generally, in a short sale with a non-recourse note, you could view it because if I have a non-recourse note, and if I instead of selling the house, I just got an agreement for the lender to reduce the note to $800,000, and I could then pay it off. If I keep the property, that $200,000 would be cancellation of debt. Even though the debt was non-recourse, the lender gave up their right. you know, to get the 200 grand because they give up the right to get the 200 grand or they have to, I have to give up the house. I got to keep the house. So that would still be considered to be cancellation of debt income under the rules we work on for cancellation of debt taxation with non-recourse debts. But the question, so what's a short sale? You know, did they just agree to let me pay it off for 100 grand and I have 200 grand of income? Or, and this is the way the IRS has generally gone down the path on this, has been, no, let's do it. Look at the real economics. The lender did this, as I explained, because it simply shortcuts them having to foreclose on the property, take the property into their inventory, try to sell it, probably get far less for it and spend more money trying to sell it than if they just took the net. So they're saying, no, we're just going to look at the underlying economics and we're going down that and use it that way. And in fact, the tax court backed that very concept in a case called 2925 Briar Park Limited versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 1997-298. Okay, so we've got our facts set up here. Now, here's what we have. The taxpayer in this case entered into a short sale. Okay. Short sale of their principal residence in Oregon. Now, under Oregon law that affects this, what had happened here with Oregon, Oregon had a rule that said, should be about the same thing in this case. If the property is subject to an obligation secured by a trustee's foreclosed upon, basically their ability to get additional funds is going to be essentially, turns down the nature of the property in the foreclosure proceeding. If the trust deed has been recorded, right? If there's a recorded trust deed, residential trust deed, then whether it's a judicial foreclosure or a trust or mystery of foreclosure, they are barred from pursuing a deficiency. However, if they instead, if this is not recorded as a trust deed, so I loaned you money, used it to buy your house, it's not recorded as a deed of trust, then essentially, with it not being recorded, then I'm not barred from pursuing you for the deficiency, right? If I don't have that as a recorded deed, I don't have it recorded directly, then I'm not, as long as I go judicial instead of going via the administrative route, I'm allowed to collect the deficiency. Now, in this particular case, the deed was not recorded. The debt, I should say, the trust deed was not, no trust deed was issued. It was not recorded. So here's the catch. What happens now in this case? We have that, they hadn't recorded the deed of trust. It was not secured by the trust deed. Therefore, it basically, was not a non-recourse debt, even though they foreclosed on it, or at least allowed it via short sale to go away. The tax court said, because there was no judicial proceeding, we're saying there's no cancellation of debt, even though the lender could have pursued a judicial, but they didn't. The court in this case, which violates directly what the IRS has been doing since 1999, their view of this, says essentially is looking at just the opposite. They're saying that there were these two options. If the lender does not exercise the option that would allow them to go down the path, that would allow a deficiency judgment, then the debt is simply non-recourse, period, and the entire balance of the loan is considered part of the sales price. Now, in this case, that was good news for the taxpayer because the taxpayer was talking about selling their personal residence, and essentially, there was going to be just a larger loss. So it was just going to be a smaller loss. It was non-deductible either way. So essentially, we got that going. The interesting part about this, though, is this goes against the logic of this decision, goes against the position the service has pushed, and has pushed back in the last real estate crisis as well, about how this situation works where we have a choice of action. A lender could go judicial and collect the entire, get themselves a deficiency judgment, or they can go non-judicial, right, trustee sale, and they're not allowed to go after. Again, there are a number of states, again, not most, but there are a number of states, especially on the West Coast, that have provisions in the law like that. In fact, Arizona, my home state, while it has a very broad provision for debts that are used to buy the house, It has the same sort of choice of action issue if you merely have a home equity loan, right, that wasn't used to initially buy the property. And if that's true, then you have this choice of action. And obviously, based on the IRS position over the years, it's always been thought that those debts had to be treated as cancellation of debt. Now it looks like potentially, at least based on the Duffy case, that they might not be cancellation of debt. They might be part of the sales proceeds. Now, again, with a home equity loan, that could be good news or bad news. It kind of depends whether it pushes the sales price up over the basis or not. But you want to keep an eye on that because that'll be interesting. And again, keeping an eye on it because of this concern that we may start seeing defaults on loans, you know, if we go further along into an economic crisis issue. Other case we had with debt was a case of Weiderman versus Commissioner, which is a tax court memorandum decision 2020-109 issued on July 15th. Now, this particular case is looking at a provision for excluding a gain under Section 108. And specifically, it's looking at Section 108A1E, which is the exclusion for cancellation of qualified principal residence debt, you know, up to $2 million. Okay, we have that. Now, to be qualified principal residence debt, a debt must meet two tests. First, the debt must be used to acquire or substantially improve the residence. Or it could have been used to refinance a debt to the extent it's used to refinance a debt that was previously qualified principal residence debt. Okay, so remember that is your first test. But then secondly, that debt that you use to acquire or improve the residence has to be secured by the residence, or that refinance has to be secured by the residence. Okay, those are your two key tests. Let's talk about the facts of Weiderman. In this case, Weiderman used funds, got hired by a company, had to relocate. The company gave them a $500,000 loan, as I recall, you know, basically to allow them to do it. The loan had repayment terms, but it did say that if, you know, in this case, if she was fired, right, or she left, she voluntarily terminated, that the loan would be due immediately. Okay, they used this loan, a good chunk of it, about 60, let's see, it was about, let's see, approximately 60% of the loan, or actually over that, probably over two-thirds, as I recall, actually, of the loan, was used to pay for the new residence in the new location they were moving to, because she took this new job. Well, it turns out it didn't work out, so about a year later, she was terminated. The loan came due. And now they got a problem because they can't afford to pay it off. The property can't sell for enough money to pay off the first mortgage on it, plus these other funds they had used. So they negotiated a deal to reduce that debt. Now, she said, look, this was qualified principal residence debt because we used it to acquire the residence, right? It's clear. And nobody disagrees. It was used to acquire the residence. However, it was not secured by the residents. Now, in the midst of all this negotiation, they signed a couple of additional loans initially to just change the terms and to do some other things. And those later loans were secured by the residents. Okay. Now, you might think, hey, this will work now, right? The loan had actually got reduced. Eventually, the debt that got canceled, well, that was secured by it, and it refinanced the loan that was used to acquire it. But here's the problem. The initial loan was not qualified principal residence debt because it wasn't secured by the house. The refinancing, while it was secured by the house, it wasn't refinancing a debt that had already met the requirements to be qualified principal residence debt. So the problem was none of the debts qualified. So the taxpayer could not use the qualified principal residence debt exclusion to keep from paying tax on the amount that had been excluded from, you know, that basically had been forgiven of the debt. Rather, you know, they had to pick that up as ordinary income. And yes, it's ordinary income, not capital gain. And of course, because it's a traditional recourse debt, it was not part of the sales price. So it became ordinary income. So again, we have two different views, two different issues. And I used to teach a course. I mean, I wrote the course and I taught the course for many years on debt related tax issues during the real estate crisis. And, you know, these are both topics we had to spend time on. And it's interesting. The second case is perfectly in line with what we've been saying for years. The first case, as I said, the change of view of when you had choice of action in a state without deficiency statute, that's an interesting change that could be very important as we go forward, especially if people, you know, borrow heavily against the house trying to get in out of this, you know, due to COVID issues. Then turns out they can't pay the debts. The value of the house goes down and we end up with these cancellations. It could be interesting how those would work out. I hope we don't have that problem, but you know, you might want to at least be aware of how Section 108, those issues work. Okay, a couple of other things that happened this week to keep track of. The IRS gave us a couple of announcements. First, on the 14th of July, they told us about something they actually done about a week earlier. They have proposed international changes to Form 1065, the U.S. Partnership Return of Income for tax year 2021. And what the IRS says down in this notice, they said they determined that the current way we report international tax information on a K-1 is too limited. Again, the K-1 spends most of its time on things that would impact a fully domestic partnership, right? Has no international tie-ins, no international issues. Well, that's great because that's probably 95% of the partnerships they deal with. However, if you do have international, that stuff tended to require a whole bunch, you know, it had codes that all needed explanations that you had to attach text for, et cetera, et cetera. So the IRS has decided, no, we need more information about those partnerships. So the IRS has issued two brand new schedules. Okay, because I said what we currently had on Schedule K and Schedule K-1 are inadequate. So we're going to do what's essentially an additional set of pages, number of pages, for Schedule K, additional set of number of pages for each partner's K-1 if the partnership has these international issues. And the schedules we're going to issue will be a Schedule K-2, which is 20 pages long. That is the addendum to Schedule K. Has a lot more details. Now, a lot of those pages deal with a lot of very detailed information about the foreign tax credits. So the bad news is, as we'll discover, because the K-1 edition, which is Schedule K-3, it's just 22 pages, also has that. I think a lot of you are going to see K-3s. Because for the very minimal issue, at least for any partnership that has foreign taxes, that 22-page Schedule K-3 is going to come with a Schedule K-1 next year. The thing's not going to be just a nice little set of codes on the K-1, apparently. If you have foreign tax credit, we're now going to end up with 20-some pages of an additional document to go with. Now, they tell us very clearly, the instructions make clear that you do not file either of these. The instructions for Schedule K-2 and K-3 tell the partnership that if you don't have international issues, so let's say you know you're an accounting firm, operate solely inside the U.S., you don't have any foreign tax credit for any reason because you don't operate anywhere else, you're not investing in entities that have foreign tax credit issues. So bottom line, you know, you won't need to worry about it. But if your client does have foreign tax credits, investment partnerships will quite often, then you're going to be attaching these forms. Now, the IRS is looking for comments currently. You know, they want to know about this, but they seriously plan to attach this to the 2020, and I should say it'd be taxable income for years, I should say 2020, not 2021, we'll file in 21. Basically, they're looking for it for this year, the year we're in right now, partnership returns. If you deal with partnerships that do have these international items on it, you want to take a look at this new Schedule K-2 draft and Schedule K-3 draft. If you don't, you know, and if you're just, you know, you just have your clients invest in partnerships, well, obviously there's a reasonable chance that you're going to run into this problem of having to deal with the K-3 for at least foreign tax credit as well as other things. So you probably should at least glance at that. Yes, lots of pages to deal with. Lots more information that's going to come out to the IRS on foreign tax matters. Finally, we have Treasury Decision 9903 set on July 17th of 2020. Final regs on what? The IRS won a case in 2019, Montrose versus United States, in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. This reversed a decision of the trial court in D.C., the district court, that basically was the case. Let me get the guy's name here for just a second. Right, we had that of Steele versus United States, right, from 2017. The Steele case had held the IRS had no right to charge a fee for P-10s, right, for P-10s for tax preparers. The IRS, when they lost that case, they stopped collecting because the court ordered them to stop collecting the fees nationwide. However, they appealed it. The Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia overturned that decision, saying the IRS does have the authority to impose such a fee. The IRS announced last year that they weren't going to worry about it for 2019's tax returns, right? So they didn't get it up and running, for this particular tax season, but they were planning to do it for the next tax season. This gives us the new numbers. Now, they are reduced over what we had before, but nevertheless, they're still going to have to pay this money this year. And as before, it divides into two parts. There is a $21 base fee you pay to the IRS, and then we pay a $1,495 fee to the contractor who's managing the system, which I find it funny. The administrative cost of this thing is apparently equal to over two-thirds of what it costs to just run the programs. It seems kind of expensive. It seems a kind of expensive way to collect the $21 base fee. But nevertheless, that's what they're doing. Now, some people complain because there is a court challenge still ongoing for how much the IRS can charge. But clearly the Court of Appeals said they can charge an amount. The IRS said, we're not going to wait to see whether our number is valid, or good. We're just going to start collecting. Presumably, if they lose or ordered to go down and that survives appeal, they would refund the money to you for the excess. But it does mean that we start re-registering in October, you're going to have to get out your checkbook again, right? Or more likely your credit card. And you're going to be paying $35.95 to update your P-10, something you haven't had to do for a couple of years, but yes, it's coming back. Well, this week I'm going to be doing, and actually I'm doing a second one for Idaho, but the New Jersey Society's 4-hour monthly tax update will be on the 22nd. On the 23rd, I'm going to do what's going to be a 2-hour program for Idaho that's much more focused on just the, what's happened with the CARES Act and other COVID-19 relief since last we talked in Idaho back in June. The New Jersey one is the monthly update, which mainly looks at what's happened since we had our New Jersey course later in June, right? So basically just a month. The Idaho course will be slightly longer than that prime time period we're looking at and a shorter session. But that course will talk about all kinds of neat things that have gone on recently, a lot of which are COVID related, but some of which are not. So we'll talk about all that stuff. If you are able, you're a member of the New Jersey Society, you can sign up. It will be a webcast. Everything here is virtual. So far this year, I have not yet been asked or not yet at least have confirmed doing any live session. I've not done a live session yet. We're still kind of watching. There may be, I'll be doing some later this year. We'll just have to see what happens. But so far, nobody's even asked the question of whether I'd be doing a live session. So the idea hasn't even come up yet of doing a really live session in front of people. And we can have that whole long discussion later. So yes, all of this is webcast. So the good news is because it's webcast, you can take this session, even if you're sitting, if you're sitting outside on the beach in Hawaii, yes, you can take these sessions. You can sign up for them. If you're not a member of the various state societies, though, you're going to pay generally a higher fee to get in. That's usually how this works. Membership has its benefits. So we'll go that route. But we're doing the sessions this week to talk about what's been going on. And again, still a whole lot with COVID. We'll talk a little bit, too, about what we expect to happen going forward, what the status appears to be. We are told that the Senate is supposed to announce early next week their proposal for the next stimulus bill. That should allow us to start actually seeing the negotiations between the House and Senate over what will be the final bill. My guess is they will do something. They'll do it at the last minute, so it's probably going to be August 8th. They will do it after threatening not to do anything because the other side's not cooperating. I mean, we know this whole story runs out, right? We've done it a few times. So keep your eye on that, though. We do know it. The key thing to watch this time is we do know, you know, what you know when you see each side's proposal is they've already told you things they've given up because they're not in their proposal, or things they've given in on that the other side wants that they put in their proposal. So keep an eye on what's proposed by the Senate, what's proposed by the House. We already know the House bill. We're going to probably get something in between the two. So, you know, think about that. We'll see how it works out. Don't necessarily, the one thing I'll tell you for sure is we are not getting the House bill in full, or we're not getting the Senate bill in full, right? The bill will be something between those two, absent something really weird happening that just totally causes one side or the other to throw in the towel and just panic and go over to the other side. That's usually how this works. So we'll see something between the two. And again, it'll probably be August the 8th. Just fair warning. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for the week of July the 20th. Our updates are on our website every week, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You know, you can basically send questions or comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Twitter, I post on Twitter at edzollers. I also take a part of the State Society Connect groups for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, Washington. I keep an eye on all of those, and we'll jump in for some more than others because some are more active than others sessions, but I'll try to jump in on those cases. So if you have issues, you can check in there. Also, as I said, I recommend if you want, you can take a look at the subreddit/r/taxpros. That's a fairly good place. Again, open to pretty much everybody who's a tax professional, and they are the moderators there are very good at getting rid of the people just looking for free tax advice. You know, the people who are trying to do it don't want to pay a professional, but want to get things done. You know, that's like, fine. That's what our taxes is for. And I realize that's a real garbage over there, kind of messy over there. But hey, you know, you go over there, that's what you want. You're looking for free. We're not here to do free. It's a support group, right? We do that. Also, I take a look from time to time at Cal CPA's group, Tax Talk. So that's also, that is open to any CPA here in the country. So again, it's been a week. You finished the first, you know, we're on extension period now, although we're pretty far through it at this point. At least we have a much shorter period than we had before. So we'll take a look. We'll see what happens in the next week. We'll see what developments we have. I would be really shocked if we have an actual passed law by next week, but we might at least have the process going. So, you know, keep things going. Hopefully you survived the season. Hopefully you took some time off this weekend. And we will talk to you next week with more about current federal tax developments.